I'd like to call to order the November 7th meeting of the Irvine Planning Commission and ask the secretary to call the roll, please.
Commissioners Nerschel and Nolan will be absent tonight. Commissioner Wong?
Here.
Chair Pro Tem Pearson?
Here.
Vice Chair Smith?
Here.
The record will show that we have a quorum.
Thank you. We're going to have the Pledge of Allegiance, but before we begin, and I ask Commissioner Wong to lead the pledge, the pledge will be followed by a moment of silence. And tonight, during that moment of silence, I'd like to recognize our founding city manager, William Willett, who passed away. A great individual and a great city manager, and we're going to miss him both as friends and professionally. So with that, Commissioner Wong, if you'd lead us in the pledge.
Stand if you're able.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Turning to staff, are there any introductions this evening?
No introductions, Chair.
Any additions or deletions to the agenda?
No, sir.
This is now the time for public comments. This is an opportunity for members of the audience to address the commission on any item that's not on tonight's agenda. We have one that has filed a request, Susan Sayer.
Yes, hi, good afternoon. My name is Susan Sayer, and I'm a longtime Irvine resident. Anaheim launched what is known as FRAN, or FRAN, which stands for Free Rides Around the Neighborhood, on January 24th, 2019. FRAN offers free on-demand transportation for locals and visitors within a designated downtown area to call for rides using a cell phone app. There are no fixed routes, but there are 10 designated preferred stops where riders can begin or end their trip. Funding comes for partnerships with the acronym ART, which stands for Anaheim Resort Transportation, grants, and local property assessments. The Irvine Company has launched FRANC, which stands for Free Rides Around Newport Center, a free on-demand transportation system for the Newport Center, which serves a hospital, parks and recreation, retail, shopping, office, and commercial and residential units in the Fashion Island area. Balboa and Del Mar have asked for similar transportation services for their communities. The Irvine Company also has an on-demand shuttle service serving residents, businesses, and retail centers at the Irvine Spectrum. Irvine is undergoing significant increases in traffic congestions, with additional traffic that will come with RENA housing, traffic circulation problems will increase. I propose that Irvine create a free on-demand public transportation system for residents and visitors to call for rides using a cell phone app to go to the major shopping centers, IBC, Irvine Tustin Marketplace, and the Spectrum, the airport, the Irvine train station, to hotels and to the Great Park venues. I've named it, since Irvine is first with everything, I've named it FIRST, standing for Free Irvine Rideshare Transportation. The service area, therefore, should include most of Irvine. FIRST should have at least one preferred stop at each of the three major shopping centers, a stop at the airport, stop at the train station, and at least four in the Great Park for a total of 9 stops where riders can begin or end their trips. Funding for the program can come from partnerships with hotels, shopping center owners, and commercial businesses, sponsorships, grants, and from property assessments. Also, please note, traffic study methodology will change beginning July 1st, 2020. Traffic studies will no longer be based on level of service ratings, but will be based on vehicle miles traveled, also known as VMT. under SB, a Senate Bill 743, which is part of the Environmental Quality Act and has the purpose of reducing greenhouse gas emissions in order to meet California state climate goals. It provides that development residents live within 1/2 mile of public transportation. Hopefully, an on-demand public transportation system will fulfill this requirement. SB 743 also requires that traffic remediation consist of, at least in part, of removing traffic from the streets. As developers contribute to remediation funds, perhaps remediation funding could contribute to the cost related to the first program. Thank you.
Is there anyone else here in the audience who would like to address the Planning Commission on an item not on tonight's agenda? Please come forward. If not, then we'll move to commission business. Our first item of business is the approval of the minutes of the October 3rd, 2019 meeting. Just for the record, I will be abstaining. I was not in attendance at that meeting, and we do not need 3 votes to pass that. So is there a motion?
Yes, Mr. Vice Chairman, I'd like to make a motion to approve the minutes as presented.
You better second, Stephen. Is there any discussion? If not, please vote.
Motion passes 2-1 with Commissioner Smith abstaining.
That brings us to item number 2. Would staff please introduce that item?
Thank you, Chair Smith. This is going to be a presentation on beekeeping. It was an item that was discussed at the City Council, and the Council had requested that the Planning Commission receive this presentation. There is no formal staff recommendation on this item, just so you know. And Mr. Grossman will be providing the presentation on this.
Welcome, sir. If you could introduce yourself for the record, since we're on tape and that's accessible to the public, it'd be appreciated.
Okay.
Thanks.
Good evening, Commissioner and everybody. My name is Avram Grossman. I'm a 30-plus year resident of Irvine. I'm a member of the Orange County Beekeeper Association that meets at Costa Mesa. I'm a beekeeper. I teach beekeeping, and I'm here to talk about bees. So let me go ahead and jump in with starting up the computer. I wasn't sure how much time was allocated, and I decided just to give kind of a general overview of what bees and beekeeping is and the importance of it and why it's important to the city ordinances that we have. So let's see if that works. So bees 101, basically, there are bees everywhere. They're here in our natural environment. They're feral bees. They fly around, and they do what bees do. It's another hour discussion on that. But bees basically swarm. They expand their colonies and mate with other feral bees and extend the feral community, you know, throughout Southern California all the way to Florida. So feral bees has been a big problem. We have commercial bees, which are non-Africanized. The genetics help to keep the feral bees' genetics calming down. Over the last 15 years, they've noticed the feral bee aggressiveness is calmed down. I'll briefly mention how it works here. We have genetics where the queen mates with a drone. The drone will come from a feral colony, and then her offspring will be feral. So it just takes one generation to create more feral bees. When you use a queen that's not feral, her drones will be non-feral, and then he'll mate with other feral bees, and we'll have a thinning of the genetics. So having commercial bees in the community is actually a good thing. So why are bees even being talked about? They're needed for pollination. So basically, a pollinator is any insect or animal that goes from flower to flower and takes, you know, takes the stuff that's needed for pollination. And honeybees travel from flower to flower collecting nectar, pollen grains, and creating pollination. They also gather nectar and pollen to bring back to their colony as a food source. There were other animals as well, the dew pollination, hummingbirds, and we'll get into some of that here in a minute. There are about 4,000 bees, types of bee species in the United States. 1,600 of them live in California, and they're everywhere. You'll see bees in different places. The only bee that produces honey, however, is the honeybee called Apis mellifera. It's the only bee that people have been collecting food sources, honey, pollen, nectar, for 6,000 years at least of recorded history. So I won't go through reading all this, but basically honeybees are a major pollinator along with other bees like hummingbirds and so on. And I'll let you guys read that later on if you'd like. But they're very important for crop pollination, whether it be a commercial agricultural environment or someone's home backyard. And that's actually how I got into beekeeping, is there were no bees in my community and my vegetables and fruits were not doing well for years until I finally put in a beehive, and that changed all that. So the main kind of bees we see are bumblebees, which are actually starting to disappear because of spraying chemicals and pesticides and so on. We have carpenter bees. They all serve as well as pollinators. Bumblebees, by the way, are very important for tomato pollination because of the way the tomato plant needs to be pollinated. The bee vibrates in the key of C, and it actually shakes loose the pollen and causes it to, you know, pollinate the flower. Bees will pollinate tomatoes as well, but not as good as bumblebees. The best one we have around is the European honeybee, Apis mellifera. That's what we're talking about today. Let's see if that flies in. Okay. And there's actually two types of honeybees, like I alluded to before. There's the European honeybee, which actually was brought here in 1625 from Europe, and it took 235 years for the honeybee to make its way across the U.S. and establish itself in California. Normal bees, before the Africanization started taking place, there would be about 15 to 45,000 bees in a tree log or, you know, wherever it is they were deciding to create a home. In a structured beehive that beekeepers keep, there's usually between 20 and 50,000 bees in a managed hive. The Africanized honeybee, which are great honey producers, will live just about anywhere. And you'll see them in places where you don't want. So here's a little video showing gentle bees moving calmly from flower to flower, carrying out their business. They have no interest in stinging people. They're perfectly harmless unless you swat them from the rear end where the stinger is. This shows on a comb of honey that's in a managed bee how they're storing the honey. And then this shows how they fly around, and we wind up with food on our table. You've probably heard about colony collapse disorder. This is the disappearing condition of bees. It was discovered about, 15 years ago, when commercial bees in the walnut orchards were not coming back to the hive. And there was often a million beehives that they bring out to the orchards for pollination, and 40 to 50% of the bees were not returning. It's a very expensive proposition. So there are lots of reasons why there's colony collapse disorder. I won't go into all of them here, but basically it's everything that we as a society are doing. Pesticides, urban development, creating stress for them, changing habitat where they're not able to get access to food, forage for food. However, it's been noticed that bees living in an urban area in the city actually do better than out in the mountains in the rural areas, partly because we all, especially in Irvine, have flower gardens and fruit gardens, and we water year-round. So the bees actually do a lot better in an urban setting. Some basic bee terminology. The process of beekeeping is an apiculture. and that's maintaining bees in a established hive. And usually it's a wooden box designed for beekeeping. A beekeeper is known as an apiarist, and there's all kinds of apiarists that do commercial or hobby backyard beekeeping. And a place where beehives are kept could be your backyard or commercial environment with thousands of hives, and that's an apiary or a bee yard. So places where bees like to live, they'll basically live anywhere, especially the Africanized bees. They live in water meters, they live in chimneys, attics, cracks in the wall, in bushes, and they also will live in wooden boxes that the beekeeper maintains. So here's a place where you don't want to find them. And when I first started doing beekeeping, I was helping out at Mason Park cleaning these water meters out that would get infected with Africanized bees that were right next to the bike path and stinging people. So I was going in and either removing them or actually killing the bees. So that's where you don't want to find them. Where you do find them is once a year at the almond orchards in Central California, literally a million beehives brought in on truckloads. About 80% of the bees in the United States that are commercially raised are brought into California for a two-week period for pollinating the almond orchards. Without the bees, there would be no almonds. Wow. So it's pretty important. And when they're done with the almond orchards, they then move on to other farms, alfalfa and so on. So they commercial beekeepers, they actually sell the service of pollination. This is an interesting topic. I actually just talked to a neighbor who called and had a bee swarm in their backyard and panicked and got all anxious about it and called a bee exterminator and for $180 killed the bees in her backyard. I try to tell people that a swarm of colony of bees are in the process of looking for another place to live. Usually they've outgrown their colony and they're splitting the hive. When a swarm is on a tree or a bush or on an eave of someplace in a big cluster holding on to each other, there's no food, there's no brood, and there's nothing that they call home to defend. And I actually showed this one woman who was freaking out about the bees being across from the elementary school that they're actually safe at that point by putting my hand into the beehive and pulled it out and said, they don't care, that they're not in that aggressive state. Not necessarily something I would teach everybody to do, but it was effective. When bees are migrating, I recommend don't nuke them, don't exterminate them. Let them go naturally, find somewhere else to live. Hopefully it'll be in a safe place. Bees in a permanent home or in a hive will build out their colony. The queen lays eggs about 15 to 2,000 a day. As the colony gets up to about 40 to 60,000 in the colony, they'll meter how many bees they need to make. And it's a pretty interesting dynamic to study the bee biology. There are beekeepers all over the place. When I became a beekeeper, it's like buying a yellow Volkswagen Beetle. You know, you don't see them on the road, and when you buy one, all of a sudden they're everywhere. When I became a beekeeper, I started noticing there are beekeepers all over Orange County. I joined the Orange County Beekeeper Association, which has about 180 to 100 people every month to their meetings, coming from all over Orange County. We have a state beekeepers association. There's an Orange County, well, the Orange County Beekeeper Association. And even at the Great Park, there's actually established beehives there that are being managed for pollinating the fields that are out there. So we already have beekeepers and beehives in Irvine. So why is this important? Why are we talking about it? Because in the city code, it says under wild, exotic, and non-domesticated animals on keeping bees, it's unlawful. It's unlawful to keep bees, to maintain them, and a swarm, which I described as basically a involuntary migration of bees landing in someone's front yard, they're now legally liable for that bee swarm, according to the ordinance. So what I'd like to do, within Orange County, of the 22 other cities, almost a third have changed the ordinances to allow beekeeping. The last one to come on board was Fullerton, and I have all this available if you want printed copies of it. A little over a year ago, they approved to allow beekeeping and have beekeepers come and register optionally. And they've also published a guideline. It's an 8-page best of practices that they recommend people to read and follow. And it's actually a best of practices written by a well-renowned entomologist, beekeeper, researcher from Northern California. So it's been highly vetted, and it's probably one of the best guidelines available for how to keep bees in your backyard in a residential environment and do it safely. So that'll help us move forward, help you guys move forward. So what are the next steps for the city of Irvine? Is let's draft beekeeping guidelines, which we have some documents to get started on. Work on changing the city ordinance to make it legal. Do some public education about the importance of bees and the safety of bees and when to be careful about approaching beehives, how to approach a beehive. So there's a lot of education that's, I think, important to have in general about animals, you know, even coyotes, can be not as dangerous if you know how to approach a coyote or so on. So doing some education, maybe build an education center in Irvine, teach kids at the school about it. And I put in, just for fun, have the city build an apiary so we can get our own honey. And this is me as a backyard beekeeper. Usually for the commercial bees, I actually don't wear a bee suit anymore. So as long as you stay calm and move slowly, the bees don't see slow motion. If you move quickly and abruptly, they'll get startled and, you know, become defensive. So I can actually work on a hive without any protective gear. Of course, when I go out and do swarm removal, I certainly suit up. So thank you very much for your time, and let's make Irvine a place for bees to thrive. And if you have any questions or would like to do some follow-up, I'm available.
I'll turn to my commission colleagues. Questions for Mr. Rosen?
No, I appreciate the presentation. Having come from a citrus farming background, I appreciate the bees, and I know what an important element it is for growing crops, so it would be interesting to pursue this a little further.
Commissioner Wong.
Thank you, Vice Chair Smith. Thank you for the presentation, Mr. Grossman.
My pleasure.
It's very fascinating. I certainly understand the importance of the role the bees play in our ecology and environment. I certainly think this is worth pursuing. And as we go further, I really would like to see how we do outreach to neighbors who are concerned about having a beehive just next door. And, you know, how do we address the concern where a parent of a child who's potentially allergic to bee stings, and those need to be addressed? I understand a lot of city has approved. I certainly look forward. We can maybe get there one day. Let's take one step at a time. And if you can give me an idea, what step do you think the city should take next? I would appreciate it.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm a little hard of hearing, so
okay.
I mostly understood the question, so let me address it as best as I can, and that's about children mm-hmm. and getting stung by bees. There are a small population of people that are allergic to bees, and usually they know about it. And that's where the education comes in. Having managed beehives in a backyard does not change the risk of bee stings for people in the slightest. It does actually reduce it a little. Again, people will get stung by bees that are feral bees out in the community. So I know one school near my house, there was a bee swarm in the top of the tree. They evacuated the school and closed it for a day, only to discover that the bees left on their own mm-hmm. after some big expense to bring in a truck to go up and try to catch them. So there's a lot of education should be done in the community in general. Rightfully so, parents are concerned about their children getting stung, but I think if they understand the behavior of bees, a lot of that fear could be assuaged. So,
thank you. Also, last question I ask is, how do you see the city proceed with getting bees available to hobbyists in their backyard? What should be the next step the city take to allow this?
Well, following, I think, in the footsteps of the examples of the other cities that have gone through this process, and it's happening all over California where cities are adopting a bee-positive approach to beekeeping, and that is to put together some public forums, town hall meetings to address the subject, get people's opinion, listen to what they have to say, and educate people about the importance of bees and the safety of beekeeping. And just do it through that approach. So I think you guys start looking at changing the ordinance, okay. What it's going to take to do that. Rewrite the ordinance so it's be positive.
Okay, thank you.
If I might ask just a quick question, I think a direction may come out of that. Mr. Grossman, you mentioned that your presentation is in written form. Do you know or are you aware of if the council has a copy of your written presentation?
They do have a version of it, but I can scale it down.
Okay.
I did email it, and it was too big because of the videos. I could pull the videos out. And
yeah, I would suggest that in written form, you submit that to... And you could submit to any one of the council members. The council members, all of them are copied with one submission. So If you submit it to the mayor or a council member that you happen to know, that correspondence will be shared with the other council members. They can see your presentation, and clearly a change in ordinance needs to come from the council. The council is the final say on the ordinances, and they're the ones who actually initiate the process. This is a good place for you to start mm-hmm. because you'll get public exposure on it. But I would highly suggest you do that. I will certainly speak to the council member that appointed me and let them know that we heard your presentation and that you had some interest. I know that there are some things about Irvine that are unique from the other cities, for instance, our small lot size in a lot of instances, which may have a bearing on how such a change in the ordinance would be crafted if it was to go forward. Mm-hmm. So those are, I think, some of the challenges that may come up as they consider them. But as far as next steps go, I would suggest, as a former council member, you submit it to the council in written form, and that each one of us communicate with our own appointing council members that we have heard your presentation and that we'd like them to review the material that you sent in.
Okay, actually, I believe that's already been done. I know Christine Shea, the mayor, is already aware of this process.
Well, I'm her appointee, so I will make sure that she's doubly aware of that then. Any further questions for Mr. Grossman?
No.
Mr. Gross, thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. That brings us to item number 3. Staff, if you would introduce that, please.
Thank you, Chair Smith. The Planning Commission had previously requested a study session on freeway signs, and so we're here tonight to do that. Joel Belding, Principal Planner, will provide the staff report on that.
Good evening, Commissioners. Again, Joel Belding, Principal Planner. So this was called for in early October after reviewing the freeway technology sign proposed by the Irvine Company. Late September. So this presentation, sort of informal, will walk through basically six different categories of freeway signs that the city of Irvine has. And just as a preface, the sign code for the city of Irvine does not contain any type of freeway-oriented sign. So that's not a category of sign that we have. And so all of these are based on basically taking monument signs and then upsizing them for whatever the particular location is. So I analyzed basically every sign that has been approved. There's 28 in the city that have been approved over basically the last 20 years, and sort of figured out what those metrics are, what the average size of sign is compared with how much activity there is on a site, and also for a given site size, how many freeway signs. What it showed is for each of these sign types, or for these office signs, I'm happy to walk through any of these details. But generally what it shows is there's a wide degree of variability for sign sizes and numbers of signs based on locations of these, the types of uses, the types of activities that are happening at these centers. There wasn't a one clear, one size fits all standard that resulted from doing sort of unwinding the approvals to see. Generally, retail centers have more sign area per amount of activity. They may have more tenants on site. Offices are typically smaller, and then we do have auto center signs, which are in sort of a separate category, and they sort of land in the middle of between the amount of sign area between office uses and retail uses. Again, because of fewer tenants, you may have single-purpose signs, but there's only four of those really on the south side outside the auto center district as a whole. One category of sign that we have, there's two of these signs. These are sort of district signs that represent multiple ownerships. Sort of collections of businesses that are maybe have an owner's association that manages them. So the two are the Riverside Auto Center, which is a very special purpose sign, doubly so because it's one of the few LED signs that we have. And then Irvine Old Town is another one. It's sort of a defunct sign right now. It's not being very maintained. It does advertise two of the three tenants that it was originally designed to identify. Traveland is still present on the sign, although no longer in place. We've been in contact with the property owner. It's actually Jack in the Box that solely owns the sign to try to get some upgrades, and that's an ongoing process. And there's only one sign in the city that's a single-user freeway-oriented sign. This is Kia along the 261. It's not very visible, and again, at 255 square feet, it doesn't deviate much from the standard monument sign that are allowed. But in general, because these signs start with a monument sign design, which is generally 10 feet by 15 feet in area, and then require something called administrative relief, which is sort of the legal mechanism to deviate from the established standards. It's city policy for some time now to refer any signs that require administrative relief that are specifically oriented toward freeways to come before the Planning Commission. Any other sign that requires administrative relief would go to the zoning administrator, but given the visibility of these and the very unique nature of these types of signs, we have a longstanding policy of just automatically referring to them to the Planning Commission, to the highest level of review for these types of things. So again, as I mentioned, these are just calling out two unique sign designs within the city, so two LED signs, Irvine Auto Center, and then most recently approved the Irvine Spectrum Center. Again, large signs for sort of key unique features within the city. Irvine Spectrum, obviously a regional draw, many millions of square feet of activity happening there. And then the Irvine Center, Auto Center, a unique collection of businesses within the city. So just to let you know, that we're currently reviewing three freeway-oriented signs that will require administrative relief that will be coming to the Planning Commission over the next couple of months. One is a proposed Great Park neighborhood sign. This would be located, again, close to the freeway. Has a proposal for an LED sign. The design is close to being finalized and will be presented to the Planning Commission at some point. I don't have a definite date for that. This is somewhat unique compared to the other categories of signs that we have reviewed so far, in that, as proposed, it would identify an entire planning area rather than just a specific office tenant or office campus or retail collection. and not just a district within a planning area, but an entire planning area, which is a mix of private activity and then potentially Great Park City public activity. The one, actually, this is scheduled for the next Planning Commission in the second meeting in November, Irvine Concourse. They originally had approval, these large concrete wall sections. There was a prior approval in 2015 where they had large signs proposed on there. They couldn't come to an agreement. They're proposing to modify that to have individual tenants listed on sort of rails that will project from the parking structure, which results in an overall decrease in the amount of sign area. We'll go into full detail about that at the next Planning Commission meeting, but somewhat unique in that this is a building-mounted collection of signs that are freeway-oriented rather than a freestanding, typical freeway sign. And then the third, this is for Jamboree Center. The Irvine Company already has a small triangular sign. This is directly north of Park Place, which has three large signs. This is more consistent with the Los Olivos signs that have been approved and the Irvine Spectrum Terrace Center that was the most recent freeway sign approval by this body. Five tenants, sort of a standard side. This one's actually consistent with the averages of the office tenant, office campus signs that we've analyzed in the past, so it's sort of extending that trend rather than proposing anything that's completely new. So as I mentioned, the approvals have varied pretty widely in terms of size, location, and number, partly based on unique site characteristics and locations along the freeways. Developing a single standard from sort of amalgamating all the prior approvals may be a little bit challenging. And because creating a new freeway sign category would create a by right ability for certain property owners within those established parameters, they could come in and just pull building permits to have additional freeway signs rather than requiring, rather than requiring a more discretionary process of having to come to the Planning Commission. And so, and you could also, by creating a one-size-fits-all standard, you could have signs that are larger than appropriate for certain sites, and that's, so potentially one consideration that you may want to take into account tonight. So really, as staff sees it, there's two directions, two options before the Planning Commission tonight. Number one is direct staff to dig a little bit deeper and prepare a code amendment to submit back to the Planning Commission and go through a public vetting process to develop a freeway sign category. The second is to retain basically status quo, keep the regulations as they are. And what that does is it guarantees that any new freeway sign proposed that requires administrative relief would come back before this body for individual consideration. And at that point, that concludes my presentation. I'm happy to go into detail about any of the signs that have been approved or any part of the analysis that we've done to be here tonight.
Joel, thank you very much for the presentation. I'll turn to the first to the secretary. Do we have any requests to speak on this item from the public? I'm not seeing anything
on
my screen.
One from David Babb.
Was there anybody here? David, did you wish to please come forward? Oh, there we go. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is David Babb. I'm a consultant to the Irvine Company and others for the last 30 years, during which time I have been the applicant for sign programs for 83 properties that have been approved by the city, 18 apartment communities, 19 office parks, 24 shopping centers, and 22 residential villages. 15 of these sign programs include freeway pylons as a sign type. I'd like to read a letter. I think you might have it. Do you have the letter from to Pete Carmichael from Roger DeWong?
We do.
Okay. Yes. Just to highlight a few things. This is from Irvine Company Office Properties. Our experience is that freeway identity is very important to attracting new businesses and to keeping existing businesses in Irvine. New, fast-growing, technology-oriented companies who are creating jobs and driving the economy are seeking more visibility than others desired in the past. And an established business with offices in a freeway adjacent property, but located in a building that is not visible from the freeway benefits when its name can be displayed on a freeway pylon. Unlike many other cities in Orange County, Irvine has four distinct freeway-oriented business districts: the Irvine Business Complex, UCI Research Park, the Marketplace area, and Irvine Spectrum, which results in numerous frontages where freeway signs are appropriate. In response to this freeway exposure, the City of Irvine has approved the use of freeway pylons in each of these business districts, as shown on the attached exhibit. I think, do you have that exhibit?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good.
We do.
Since the maximum size of monument signs in the zoning code is determined solely by the use of the site rather than by the size of the site or the width or speed of the adjacent streets, we support the zoning ordinance's current two-tiered process to approve signs. Typical signs where there's no public hearing because the signs comply with the standards in the zoning ordinance. And then there's special signs where a public hearing is required to approve a sign program to allow signs that are designed to respond to unique attributes such as the size of the site or the character of the adjacent streets. If the existing sign standards in the zoning ordinance are to be revised, Irvine Company would like to be part of the process and suggest that the current term for approving variations to the maximums in the zoning ordinance be called alternative standards rather than administrative relief, since the administrative relief action is discretionary, not administrative, and since it is related to site-specific justification and not to relief. The exhibit attached to the letter shows 21 locations of city-approved freeway pylons. 10 of those locations were approved in the 1990s, 6 in the first decade of the year of the 2000s, and 5 since 2010. So it's a decreasing number of freeway pylons have been approved. And these freeway pylons are beneficial in 4 ways. First, wayfinding helps inform drivers, especially first-time shoppers, dining patrons, hotel guests, and truck drivers, where to exit the freeway, preventing unnecessary congestion on the surface streets. 2, business identity helps inform freeway drivers that a company has an office in Irvine, contributing to Irvine's reputation as a desirable business location, assisting to implement Objective A2 of the general plan to promote dynamic employment centers. 3, retail identity. These signs help with the economic success of Irvine's shopping centers and hotels by promoting their identity, assisting to implement Policy H of Objective A2 of the general plan to retain businesses, and Policy F of Objective A4 of the general plan to attract land uses that generate revenue to the city. And then finally, 4, city identity. The freeway pylons with the word Irvine inform freeway drivers that they are in Irvine, assisting to implement Policy A of Objective A1 of the general plan to develop identifiable city landmarks. With me tonight is Tom Grubel, who is the Vice President of Leasing for Irvine Company Office Properties. He has more than 20 years of experience working in the Irvine area and is very knowledgeable about the office market, if you'd like to ask him any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Babb. Do we have anybody else who'd like to address the commission on this particular issue? If not, before taking commission questions and comments, I want to turn to the city attorney for just a moment. Madam City Attorney, this is on the agenda tonight as a study session. I know there are no action items connected with this on the agenda. What are we able to do in terms of any kind of direction tonight to staff, since this does not have an action attached to the agenda?
At most tonight, you can provide direction about a future agenda item. So if you would like this to come back as a code amendment, that's direction you can provide tonight, that you'd like this to be brought back. But this isn't going to be a time to actually discuss whether you would support a code amendment, just that you'd like to explore it further.
But it would be appropriate for us as commissioners to discuss as per Mr. Belding's presentation, whether or not we wanted to keep the ordinance as is or move, or not move, but to have staff consider some modification of the ordinance that would be appropriate. Okay, very good, thank you. And with that, I'll turn to fellow commissioners. Who'd like to go first here? Commissioner Wong.
Sorry, mic wasn't on. So this is for Principal Planner Belding. Is there any reason why we would change the ordinance at this point in time?
So in theory, you could, there's plenty of motivations why you could want to pursue a change, either to limit the proposals that you would receive in the future, to make it very strict, mm-hmm. and to make it very clear that signs, that there are certain signs you wouldn't want to consider at all. And then that would allow staff to direct applicants to simply to ward off future applications for certain signs that you would find unacceptable. You may want to, another motivation for amending the code would be to simply not review these. There are certain categories of signs that you find completely acceptable, and so you could basically establish a new sign type, set a baseline under which you're completely comfortable with certain signs just being by right, only requiring building permits, not requiring any planning, permitting, no special approval for them. There may be other modifications, but it's you either want to exclude or allow. So you either want to close the door or narrow that opening within the door to only allow very special purpose, very highly justifiable signs, or to open the door to allow multiple lower grade signs that are less concern.
Okay, so if we're going to move forward, for example, to automatically disqualify certain signs, don't we need to come up with a definition of what the qualifications are?
So that could be, as the city attorney mentioned tonight, you could direct staff to prepare a zoning ordinance amendment that sought to basically set a high bar, and then in theory you could exclude certain sign types from the administrative relief process, even if you really wanted to make it very strict, to put it into a variance category, to create some. Tonight you could provide general direction to craft a sign ordinance that allows certain types of signs or that precludes the proposing of certain types of signs on sites that are smaller than a given size or that have less than a certain amount of activity on them. You could give us general direction to sort of establish where that threshold is, and then we would return back to you with specific language that sought to accomplish your goal.
Okay. Just for the freeway signs, I understand since it's really representing the city, I can't speak for my fellow commissioners, but I would be more comfortable if we are able to review it as we have done, as the process existing currently going forward. So that's it.
Commissioner Pearson.
Thank you, Joel. My biggest issue, I think, is consistency of signage within the city. Number one, I think anything that is large in nature, you know, hundreds of square feet, should not be an administrative, you know, acceptance. It should go to the Planning Commission. I think a lot of times we look at the issues of small directional signage within a business complex. We look at a lot of, you know, low-level signage approvals. I think that my feeling is that staff should come up with some type of a consistency and then a line of demarcation where staff thinks or recommends to the Planning Commission that they look at the, you know, a level that is of concern. If it's facing a public right-of-way, if it's on a freeway, if it has, you know, distinct observable qualities. You did an analysis where you were comparing acreage, sign square footage, how many signs per, you know, acre. I mean, if you could come up with some type of a standard where we look at the size of the property and what type of signage would go onto that property for public view. You know, there's a life safety element to this where if you're driving on the freeway, you don't want to spend, you know, 10 seconds looking at a pylon sign to try to figure out if that's the one you're supposed to go to. So, you know, I appreciate the need for the pylon signs identifying, you know, tenants, identifying retail opportunities. But I think that there is a threshold in which we should look at it as a planning commission and make a determination based upon a dialogue between the commissioners, whether or not it's acceptable or whether it should be smaller. Now, LED electric signs, you know, there are not that many. I think that should definitely be something that goes to the Planning Commission. But I think if we could develop a hierarchy of signage to where administratively it would fall on city staff to approve it, and otherwise it would come to the commission. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Pearson.
Commissioner Pearson, just to clarify, with regard to the freeway signs, staff is in a mode now where we're taking all freeway-oriented signs to the commission. So any sign that requires relief from the code, administrative relief, requires a public hearing. And since we understand the sensitivity of freeway signs and some of the issues you raise relative to adjacency to public spaces, you know, the speed of folks traveling along arterials, we feel that freeway signs rise to a level that does require some planning commission review and input. So status quo for us would be bringing all of these to the commission for your deliberation.
Thank you.
I've been giving this a lot of thought since we spoke about it a number of meetings ago, asking for this study session. Let me say that I do agree with Mr. Babb at part of his presentation where he talked about the value of the freeway signs. I think they really are valuable, not only to the city, but to the region, and it does bring direct benefit to the city in terms of recognition and sales tax dollars and those kinds of things. But I think more important, to me anyway, are our community standards. One of the reasons why Irvine has remained such a great community for the almost 50 years it's been around is that we maintain a very high standard. And I think the reason we do maintain such high standards and haven't experienced the kind of decay that other suburbs do when they get to 50 years old is because our standards are high and because we have a high level of review. And I think with bodies like the City Council and the Commission, I might say a high level of control. And with that comes a very important piece, and that's public transparency, that all of these signs would, the freeway signs in particular, would come to us or to the city in a public setting where electeds or appointeds to the electeds have an opportunity to interact with the public and debate the merits of these kinds of things and the appropriateness of their appearance or their placement against our standards, and to do that in public. I think that's very important. There's also a uniqueness, I think, in each one of these signs. For instance, was it two meetings ago or three meetings ago, we did the freeway sign for the industrial park, the business complex, near the 133 flyover.
Correct.
That sign was really large, but it was appropriate because of its placement near the flyover on the freeway. If that had been in another location where there wasn't that kind of a flyover, I think the commission may have looked at that differently, and I think staff would have as well, and said, you know, maybe we need another design in that location. Because these are unique, and because they're on a freeway where there are lots of things like on-ramps, off-ramps, flyovers, whatever, each one of these has its own set of positives and negatives. And for those reasons, I can't see a reason to change our present policy. I think the policy that we have now of bringing all of these to the commission is certainly appropriate. The other thing I'm concerned about is anytime we write a standard or we add certain qualifications, I think, as Mr. Belding said in his presentation, if that standard is met, for my interpretation of that, that means it's not reviewable. And if it's not reviewable, that means that we may end up with something that's outside of our standards or outside of what might be termed public acceptance. And so for those reasons, as much as I'd like to make things, the process simpler for our business community, I'm not willing to sacrifice our oversight and the public transparency to be able to do that. And so for those reasons, I think I would be supportive of keeping the process and policy as it is. Further commission comments or questions, folks? Commissioner Pearson.
Yeah, Mr. Vice Chairman, I agree with your comments. It would be interesting to see, though, what staff would recommend, if there is any recommendation, to enhance or change the current statutes. I'm just thinking that, you know, the community standards, there are various levels of signage, and some of it is appropriate for us to look at, and some of it, if it is internal, if it is on a building that does not have pure public recognition, it may be something that we want not to have come to the commission. So I'm just wondering whether or not we should have staff take a further look at anything that could be altered, and then our full panel of commissioners make a decision on whether or not it's appropriate.
Commissioner Pearson, just to make sure I understand correctly, because we'll synthesize this in direction to the staff, are you speaking strictly about freeway signs, or are you talking about all signage?
Oh, I was talking about all signage.
All signage. Okay, I wanted to make it, because that's a really important distinction.
No, as I said earlier, that I believe that every parcel has a different physical characteristic. Everyone, as you mentioned, similar to the industrial at the 133, has various opportunities for view. And I think those all should be coming to the commission. Not only freeway signage, but any of our major infrastructure signage. You know, if it's on a multi-lane arterial, I think we should look at anything that is a project identifying or an asset identifying sign. My other side of this is the internal signage within projects that, if they meet the standards, then I don't think that it should be something that the commission should spend the time on. That's
just so I'm clear, and then Commissioner Wong, I saw you taking notes. I'll move to you in just a second. Are the three of us then in agreement on the large freeway signs that they should continue forth in the way they're being presented and the way they're coded? Am I interpreting that correctly?
Yes, on my part.
Hey, Commissioner, okay, so as far as freeway signage goes, then I would think the commissioners here would not recommend any changes to that policy, that all of those are fully reviewable and come before Planning Commission automatically. And so I think, Commissioner Pearson, now you're talking about another level of asking staff to review. I'm restating this because I want to make sure I'm accurate, to review the standards for signage that is below the freeway sign level in terms of hierarchy, and see perhaps if there are staff would have some recommendations on how to change and perhaps streamline the balance of the sign ordinances.
That's correct.
I'm sorry. Thank you very much for that clarification. Commissioner Wong.
Thank you. And, you know, I'm only focused on the freeway sign, and I'm glad to see we all agree. And hopefully Chairman Nersho and Commissioner Nolan would as well.
What my dad used to call out of the room, out of the deal.
I do feel bad that Commissioner Nolan is not here, because I believe this was actually her request to have the study done.
Yeah.
So in terms of freeway sign, we all agree it needs to be here because it is presenting the public face of Irvine. It's representing our businesses, and no question about that. The perfect example, Vice Chair Smith brought it up, and we do have the ability to review individual project based on the site and the needs of the project. To Commissioner Pearson, I don't recall we have ever reviewed signage beyond freeway signs. But my tenure on the commission has been very short. So in terms of interior signs, I believe if they're not beyond standard, they're automatically approved. Is that correct?
Yeah, just as a point of clarification, so as the commission may recall, a year ago we brought forth a zoning code update. One of those updates that we did were internally facing signs to a commercial center or a project that weren't visible from the public right away could be approved at a staff level through a permit process.
Okay. If I might interject here, I think maybe what Commissioner Pearson was referring to, we've had a fairly large number of what I'll call, I think, proper nomenclature, sign programs where we do freeway signs for a new project, but we're also doing the internal direction signs and the signs on the building. And I have a feeling, Commissioner Pearson, that's what you were referring to.
Yes, Mr. Vice Chairman.
And that's
Chairman.
Part of the overall sign program mm-hmm. when a whole new, what's the name of the new center that we approved a few months ago at the 133 and the 405.
The technology center.
And we did not only freeway signs for that, but we did internal direction
and the Spectrum Terrace.
Yeah,
Spectrum Terrace.
Yeah,
so and that yes, Mr. Vice Chairman, that is where I'm trying to focus. Is we should be looking at the major signage, which is for public view, the internal signage, and I do recall going through the session with staff on the parameters of acceptable signage. And so long as that is met, and it doesn't, you know, and it's administrative approval, then that's fine with me. I just was taking it beyond that, since we have had master plans come in for signage, and we've been asked to approve the entire signage package.
I'm sorry to interrupt there, Commissioner Wong. I just wanted to clarify that. Please go ahead.
No, actually, your clarification made it a little bit, actually, totally understandable what Commissioner Pearson is stating or his position. And I have, you know, freeway signs were treated differently, obviously. Rest of them, I would certainly be supportive of creating a program where signage standards can be set.
I don't know, Mr. Garrick, if that's as, if we're as clear as mud as a commission on this or not. It sounds like what we're saying is on some of what I would call lower priority approvals, perhaps like internal direction signs when a whole sign program comes before us, is, and I'm not saying this negatively because I do agree with you, but would it create more havoc than it would ease if we were to break out parts of the sign program like that in the ordinance and say some of it comes to Planning Commission and some of it is just done administratively? Is it better to do it all in one presentation and one approval?
Well, and just as a point of clarification, this may help the discussion. The way the existing sign ordinance is set up is that if a sign is proposed and it meets the standards of the code, then it goes through an administrative process where staff can approve it. If it's something that's deviating from the sign ordinance, then that's when it kicks it into a public arena and the public process, and either the zoning administrator or the Planning Commission has to review and approve that.
So then, taking what you've just said and turning to the three of us then, are we saying that the present system of approval, that the standards perhaps are not broad enough to take care of the smaller signs, or like the direction signs and things, or the standards are not clear enough, or is there some other direction that we want to go?
I think given what Tim has just said, that we have the structure to be able to administratively approve anything that doesn't deviate from the standards. And if it deviates, it comes to commission. So that satisfies, so long as the standards are acceptable, then it satisfies, you know, my whole issue.
If that's the case, and maybe just a quick polling, if it, we're not we're not voting, we're polling, whether or not the between the three of us, the present standards are acceptable and the process that the staff is going through is acceptable. Commissioner Pearson?
I think the process is acceptable, and I believe, given that we went through the standards not too long ago, that the entire process is probably acceptable.
Commissioner Wong?
I agree with Commissioner Pearson. I think the process is, it works very well, and the standard we have set up, just, you know, according to Deputy Director Garrett, who was set up last year, and so far I have seen no reason to deviate from it.
I agree with you as well, so that makes us unanimous, and given that we are in accord on this, then I would assuming then that we would be saying in summary that the present system is acceptable to us and no changes would be necessary at this point. Is that okay? I think that's where we are. Any further discussion? If not, we'll close the study session then, and we'll move to item number 4. Staff, please introduce the item.
Thank you, Chair Smith. This is a staff presentation, an update on the Regional Housing Needs Assessment, RENA methodology, and Marika Pointer, Principal Planner, will provide the staff report with Kerwin Lau, Manager of Planning Services.
Welcome, and thank you for the staff report.
Good evening, Vice Chair Smith and members of the Planning Commission. The item before you this evening is an update on the Regional Housing Needs Assessment, or the RENA methodology. The RENA is required by state law, and it requires jurisdictions to plan for housing needs. The RENA distribution is the responsibility of the Southern California Association of Governments, or SCAG. The RENA occurs every 8 years, and we are currently planning for the sixth cycle, which is July 2021 to October 2029. The RENA process is divided into four main steps: the regional determination, the methodology, the draft jurisdictional RENA allocation, and the final RENA allocation. The California Housing and Community Development, or HCD, provided SCAG with their initial regional determination of 1,344,740 units back in August. SCAG then filed an objection with HCD on the regional determination based on the process, and this number was revised to 1,341,827 units. The difference had to do with tribal land, and it's roughly 3,000 units. SCAG's Regional Council initially released the three draft RENA methodology options for public comment in August. And the methodology is used to disperse the regional allocation to all 197 jurisdictions in the SCAG region. SCAG received over 250 comment letters on the initial three draft methodologies. And then on October 1st, SCAG introduced what is called the SCAG staff recommended RENA methodology as the only option. The RENA subcommittee voted in favor of the SCAG staff recommended RENA methodology on October 7th, 2019, and the SCAG Community Economic and Human Development, or CEHD, committee recommended the SCAG staff recommended RENA methodology to the Regional Council for approval on October 21st, 2019. The City of Irvine submitted two separate comment letters, one on September 12th and one on October 4th, identifying the following high-level concerns: that the selected methodology should be based on local input, or what our general plan outlines, newly introduced methodology factors such as jobs accessibility and transit accessibility have not been adequately reviewed and verified, and the City of Irvine opposes the inappropriate use of some of the proposed factors, and the late release of the methodology limits the city's ability to review and provide substantive comments. As it so happens, today on November 7th, the Regional Council took action on the RENA methodology and went in a totally different direction on a substitute motion. Essentially, they eliminated local input, which is our first bullet point. They based most of it on jobs accessibility and transit accessibility, which haven't completely been reviewed and verified. And then it was made at the last moment, so it was a very late release of the methodology limits. So as I mentioned today, on November 7th, the Regional Council did adopt a preferred RENA methodology. They will now send that up to HCD for a 60-day review and comment period. After that, SCAG will receive comments on it and can either take HCD's recommended actions or can leave the methodology as is. In winter 2020, we expect the release of the draft jurisdictional RENA allocation. At that point in time, we will get the City of Irvine number. And then in the summer of 2020, there is a RENA appeal period. And then in October 2020, the SCAG Regional Council has to adopt the final RENA allocation. And then we have 1 year till October 2021 for jurisdictions to have their housing elements certified by HCD. And that concludes my presentation. I'm available for any comments.
First of all, thank you for your presentation. I'm laughing because at least I know from one member of this commission, which is me, my comments are not going to be very favorable. And I want you to know that this is not aimed at you, that you are merely the messenger, and I am definitely not shooting the messenger. However, I definitely am going to take to task those people who are sending the message. But first, I think I'll turn to my fellow commissioners and see. Commissioner Wong, I don't have, my screen's not working, so are you up first?
Commissioner Smith, Wong? Do we want to take public comments?
Oh, do we have public comment?
Susan Sayer.
Oh, I'm so sorry. My screen wasn't up. Susan, please come forward. Thank you.
Yes, hi again. Good afternoon. My name's Susan Sayer, and I've lived in Irvine for decades. Now, I share the concerns of apparently the city council and city staff and council member Carol being the SCAG's representative about the RENA distribution and the methodology. Admittedly, the need for affordable housing is great. However, the means for assessing the affordable housing need must be accurate as possible. The means for fulfilling the assigned RENA numbers must be both affordable and possible to achieve, and our infrastructure must be capable of supporting the assigned RENA numbers. Furthermore, as Irvine has a large amount of inaccessible acreage consisting of park acreage, flood channels, and property with open space designation, the use of this inaccessible acreage to support Irvine's RENA numbers distribution is unreasonable. Need assessment should be based on family units, not on population. I know of very few households with one resident, as the majority of the population shares housing units with family members or multiple roommates. It makes sense to base need assessment on household units rather than on total population. As developers fund above moderate income housing, eliminating the above moderate RENA classification significantly reduces the ability of Irvine and other cities to afford building housing in the very low and moderate income classifications. How will Irvine fund the RENA units with lower affordability classifications? Perhaps Irvine can make development agreements which require developers to include lower affordability classifications in their above moderate income housing projects. The prohibition against appeals of RENA number distribution based on the lack of infrastructure appears unreasonable and should be repealed. A number of cities lack the infrastructure, according to what I understand, to support their RENA assignments and cannot afford the cost of infrastructure improvements to support the RENA distribution. Irvine grid streets already have more traffic that they can efficiently support. Our grid streets support Irvine traffic as well as traffic from neighboring county communities and other neighboring cities. Irvine, which lacks efficient public transportation system, lacks the transportation infrastructure to support the added RENA households that are to be assigned to Irvine and the neighboring communities. As OCTA is reducing its buses and bus routes in Irvine, this also raises the issue of the need for Irvine's circulation-only public transportation system that can connect with the OCTA intra-community bus system and the Metrolink train system. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Susan. I'm so sorry I missed that. I'm glad you were able to do that. Commissioners, who's Commissioner Wong, are you up first? Again, my screen is not working here, so.
Okay. Thank you, Vice Chair. Obviously, for all of us, the portion about local control is very troubling because we...
Thank you.
Technology issue resolved. Okay, sorry, my thought got interrupted. Okay, local control. Obviously, that part of the SCAC report is very troubling, and I have read Mayor Shea's letters to SCAG, and thank you for the update. I know it's late, so I'm trying to process that right now. However, you know, looking at the number 21,500 additional housing units within the next 10 years, that's twice as many units as it is currently in PA 51, if my math is correct. So that's a obviously very challenging task. Is there anything else we can do? Staff, can you give us a response?
So there's many factors that you can include in your housing element. One of the opportunities that has come up through the state legislature is the ability to have accessory dwelling units at homes. I believe that that is the concept that was moved forward by the legislatures that brought those forth, in that you could address the housing crisis by allowing accessory dwelling units in more places. So that would be one option. And then also just reevaluating opportunity sites within the city that may be available for housing.
Okay, let me stop for now. Maybe Jeff would like to chime in.
Commissioner Pearson.
Yes, thank you. Marika, just so I understand, the RENA numbers are for what period of time? The numbers that we've got in front of us, which based upon, you know, is 21,000 something. And when do these have to be online? What's the timeline?
So we have to site for them in our housing element, and then you are supposed to construct them between July 1, 2021 and October 30th of 2029.
Okay, so it's essentially a 10-year period.
Correct.
Given the breakdown from very low to moderate, do we have sufficient capacity within the city to even build out the total number of units to be able to provide these numbers?
We have a 15% inclusionary housing ordinance, and so that will accommodate some of it. If we receive a very large number, I believe HCD, so the state organization, will only accept a 15% inclusionary. Only jurisdictions that can demonstrate a 20% and have historically done that can include that in their housing element. So if you're doing the math, you would have to add more units in the aggregate to accommodate the affordable, unless you have developers that are coming in and are willing to build 100% or near 100% affordable on their own and take a loss of profit.
So my other question then is, physically, with the remaining number of lots that could potentially be built within the city, can we achieve these numbers in the next 10 years?
We haven't done an adequate site analysis at this point in time. What we have are our previous two RENA cycles that we can take a look at and see what's remaining. Another caveat is that there's been a bunch of housing legislation that's come through in the past year and a half or 2 years, and one of those precludes you from using sites that have been used for two cycles. So if you happen to have a site that was used in the fourth cycle and the fifth cycle and is still sitting vacant, then you can't use it in your next cycle unless you make it by right. Fortunately, in doing a preliminary review of things, our number was so high in the fourth cycle at roughly 35,000 units. We included a lot of properties in the IBC in that. And then our fifth cycle, our number was lowered down to 12,149. So a lot of the sites that we included in the fourth cycle from the IBC were not included in the fifth cycle. Okay. So that does give us the ability to still use those sites if they're still vacant.
Okay, thank you very much.
I don't want to make any flippant remarks here, because this is a very serious subject, and I could talk on this for hours, but I'm not going to. I'm just going to make a couple of points. This seems, I don't want to use a comedian's words, but I can't think of anything more appropriate than a quote from Groucho Marx. Politics is the art of looking for trouble, finding it everywhere, diagnosing it incorrectly, and applying the wrong remedies. And that's exactly what's happening here. To take away local control and vest it, the future of our community, in unelected people. And let me remind everybody in the audience that SCAG, although made up of elected folks like council members from other cities, the body itself is unelected. It's appointed, as is HCD. So people who have no stake in our community are going to basically tell us how high to jump and in which direction, which is absolutely and totally wrong. The methodology, in my way of thinking, which basically applies a uniform, if you will, overview of everything, to a city like Irvine, who has done more for affordable housing in the past 40 years than any other community I can think of in all of California, is absolutely ludicrous. The numbers that they're talking about, 1,300,000 units, I think is wrong. And I base that on readings I've done, particularly from Jim Doty, the past president of Chapman University, had a very interesting article recently showing how those numbers were developed by using averages taken from other states, including Utah, where the number of people per household is twice what it is in California. And it skews the numbers by counting the homeless and saying that homelessness is a housing problem when in fact it's a mental illness and substance abuse problem primarily. And just adding more units isn't going to take care of it. And then putting that all on the back of the cities and expecting us to take in higher density, all the traffic, and destroy our general plan and all our local standards is just absolutely ludicrous. And I know this is a receive and file, and the only thing I would like to do, and I don't know if my fellow commissioners agree with me, is to send a strongly worded memo to our city council saying the best thing you can do on this is sue. Because I, as a resident of this community and as a sitting commissioner, are in no way going to be satisfied with any kind of a modification and accept this in any way, shape, or form. I'm totally opposed to it from one end to the other. And I don't wish to or want to see our community destroyed strictly from a group of politicians who are looking for trouble everywhere, diagnosing it incorrectly and applying the wrong remedies. And then when they're done, I'll let you know exactly how I really feel. Commissioner Pearson.
I want to thank you, Greg, for sugarcoating that those comments right now. I definitely agree with you, and I think that Irvine is being subjected to edicts coming from afar that do not recognize what this city has done over the course of the last 40 years and has provided, you know, exceptional low and very low and moderate income opportunities. I think I agree with you. I don't think. I agree with you that we should send a note to our city council that, based upon the presentation of what has been given us tonight, that we object to the rationale and the outcome, and that we would advise you to take this matter up after it's presented in, the winter of 2020.
Thank you, Commissioner Pearson. Commissioner Wong.
Thank you. No disagreements there. We need to maintain our local control, obviously. We moved to Irvine for the reason of high quality of life. And as a city, I'm aware we have done as much for the low-income residents here. So I do agree we should do everything possible to rectify the situation we're facing right now. That's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And again, to staff, you are in a very tough position. I appreciate you presenting it clearly to us. I know that this is certainly not your doing. Our staff is wonderful and does everything to protect this city, and I appreciate everything that you do for us. My beef is really with a state government who continually tries to wrest control from us, whether it be housing, whether it be cell phone towers, whether it be street sizes, no matter what it is, they think they know best, and clearly they don't. And you only have to look at this, at the status of some of our larger cities here in the state to know how badly they're doing in terms of success. We are a success story, they are not. I guess if you want to, it doesn't necessarily have to be a memo, just communicate to the City Council that this commission strongly objects and suggest to the council, if I'm stating this incorrectly, please correct me, that they that all avenues are open as far as we're concerned, and that they do everything in their power, including legal action, to ensure that what the state is trying to force on us doesn't happen. Is that fair, fellow commissioners?
Yes.
Thank you. And with that, we have concluded item four, and we'll move to staff reports. Any staff reports this evening?
No staff reports.
Any planning commission reports this evening? Commissioner Wong.
Just one question, and this is for Director Carmichael and Deputy Director Gerich. In speaking with the residents here in Irvine, there has been some interest in getting the planning commission meeting on television as well. Is it possible for the staff to do a report on what resources it would require financially or human resources to make this happen?
Yes. I'll call on you, Pete. That's okay.
Please. We'd be happy to come back, and we can report out on sort of the cost implications and how that might work. I would note, starting, I think, last week, David, we did start posting an audio file of each meeting on the transparency portal and the community development webpage, but we can take the next step and come back with some more info about what it would take to live stream or post video.
Thank you.
Very good. Commissioner Pearson?
I've said enough.
I think we all have. If not, then we have a meeting on the 21st, if I'm correct, so we'll adjourn to the regular meeting of November 21st. Have a good evening.